Today on Maine Calling, illicit cannabis grow houses raided in several Maine counties. Week after week, it's in the headlines. Law enforcement agencies discovering yet another rural house gutted, outfitted with powerful grow lights, and converted to an illegal marijuana growing operation. Many of these raids are in central Maine, Kennebec and Somerset counties. But last Friday, police moved in on a house in York County, Parsonsfield. It was number 19. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, investigators believe there may be 200 or more of these illicit cannabis operations in Maine. Officials are investigating their links to Chinese foreign nationals and organized crime, as they have been in other states. They are also urging people to refrain from jumping to conclusions about their neighbors. What we know and don't know about this new wave of cannabis operations on Maine Calling. That's just ahead.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to island and coastal Downey's communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. One after another, rural towns in Maine are making headlines as law enforcement raids crack down on illegal cannabis grow houses. Why is this happening all over the state, and what's being done about it? Joining me for the hour, Aaron Fry, who is Attorney General for the state of Maine, John Hudak, Director of Maine's Office of Cannabis Policy, and Sebastian Rotella, who is a reporter for ProPublica, who has been writing a great deal on this topic. We invite you to join the conversation. How are these illegal cannabis operations affecting your community? You can send an email, a brief email, please, to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you all for joining us today. I'll start with you, Attorney General Aaron Fry. Characterize what's happening in Maine in terms of these illegal cannabis grow houses. I'm understanding that there are these raids happening all over the state. The only thing that seems to tie them is that they're in rural areas.
Yeah, just very good morning. Just very basically, law enforcement is leading the way in following up on complaints that neighbors might have of properties that they suspect may be growing cannabis outside of the regulatory system, right? Outside of the medical system, outside of the recreational system, outside of personal use, which are all legal in Maine. The typical investigation, you have a neighbor that complains, law enforcement will check with the Office of Cannabis Policy, will check to see if there's any reason that that property may be appropriate for growing cannabis. There'll be a request for power records through an administrative subpoena or through a grand jury record if there's no legitimate reason for there to be a marijuana grow or a cannabis grow at that property. There may be a little bit more investigation about the property and what might be going on there. And then a warrant is requested. This is important that the process is followed, because not only do we want to root out the activity that is unlawful, we also want to make sure that at the end of it, all the I's have been dotted and T's have been crossed, so that we can hold accountable under the law those who are engaging in this unlawful activity.
In the cases so far, and I understand 19 of them, what have neighbors seen? What has made them suspicious that they're reporting to law enforcement officers?
Well, my understanding is it's primarily smell. There's an odor that is consistent, strong. It's not just 1 hour out of the day. It's a lot, and not a lot of consistent traffic. And what I mean by that is you don't have, sort of a car on the driveway all the time as though somebody's living there. You see traffic going in and out, different vehicles going in and out, sometimes no one there for days. So those are typically what would motivate a neighbor to call in to say that they have concerns about the property: smell and inconsistent traffic with somebody using the residence for residential purposes.
And Aaron, some of the pictures I've seen are really dramatic. These houses look as though they've been gutted, just filled with lights, filled with plants. And we're hearing about black mold, that the houses are really just not even livable afterwards. Is that accurate? Are these pictures representative of what you're seeing over and over again?
Those are the reports coming out. Again, not every single grow looks like that, but it's, you know, these properties are being used for a specific purpose, and that is to try to evade the lawful structure that's in place for medical or recreational use. It's to fuel the black market of cannabis that not only compromises the regulatory system, but it also compromises citizen safety, consumer safety. And so there's a lack of concern that these folks who are doing this unlawfully lack of concern for the state of the property that they're growing it in, right? They're just using the property because they're out in a rural countryside. They're taking the risk that they're going to get caught. They're not concerned about whether or not that property is going to survive. And in many of these cases, by the way, I could tell you what cases we've charged, but what you read about in the paper are not always the cases that get charged, because sometimes when warrants are executed, there's nobody there, right? So again, these properties are fungible for the folks who are using them for the purposes that we're talking about today.
John, I want to turn to you because Attorney General Aaron Frey used the expression that there is, and alluded to, that there is a lawful structure in place. Marijuana is legal in the state of Maine. Tell us the difference between a legal marijuana operation and an illegal one.
So thank you, and good morning, everyone. Yeah, we have both medical and adult use cannabis regulated through Maine's Office of Cannabis Policy. As the Attorney General noted, there's also provisions in law that allow for home cultivation of a small amount of plants for personal use. But the regulatory system is well established in Maine. We've had legal medical cannabis since 1999. That system has gone through multiple versions of reform in the 25 years since Maine voters legalized it. And adult use cannabis was legalized in 2016 and has gone through some changes as well. And what happens is the state allows the construct of a commercial market. Individuals can cultivate, manufacture, and sell cannabis in storefronts throughout the state, although you do need, for the most part, local opt-in in order to do that. And so that's a comprehensive regulatory apparatus. In the adult use program, the cannabis is tracked from seed to sale, and it's tested for contaminants, and products have labeling requirements, et cetera. The illicit market has none of that. As the Attorney General noted, in many cases, the growing conditions are appalling. And cannabis is a bioaccumulator. It soaks up everything, air, water, and soil. And so contaminants that may exist out in the environment or inside in the environment of these homes are going to make their way into the cannabis plant and ultimately make their way into the consumers who purchase from the illicit market.
Well, I want to turn to you, Sebastian. You've been reporting on this nationwide, and I understand Maine is one of some 20 states where these illicit cannabis operations are proliferating. Give us a timeline of when this became prevalent. Is this something that's really happened in the last couple of years?
Well, nationwide, it's been going on for longer than that, going back to when Colorado and in particular legalized, and this has kind of evolved and moved around in a number of states, Pacific Northwest, California, Colorado. Our focus, we really looked in depth at Oklahoma, which passed a medical marijuana law in 2018 that was really kind of wide open. So you had no limit on the number or size of what there are marijuana farms, right? I mean, you had at its peak a couple of years ago, almost 10,000 marijuana farms with up to 15 to 20 workers on them, sometimes more. So you can imagine the dimensions of this. And what was going on in Oklahoma, as in places like California and Colorado, and from what I understand, Maine, as the Attorney General said, is that this marijuana is being moved around the country, particularly to the East Coast from Oklahoma, into a massive and incredibly lucrative black market. And what we really focused on as part of an ongoing series of work we've done for the past several years is the dominant role of Chinese organized crime in this activity. Chinese organized crime, which is already deeply involved in the laundering of drug money for the Mexican cartels in the Americas and in other places around the world, has really become one of the major players in this vast and incredibly lucrative sector of black market marijuana, and with all kinds of crime and quality of life issues associated with it.
So where is this black market marijuana from Maine being sold? And how, when you follow the money trail, where is that money? That money's being laundered and goes to South America and Mexico? Explain that if you can.
Well, there's two different things. What Chinese organized crime has been doing for the past decade in the United States is laundering money for the, particularly the Mexican cartels that sell fentanyl and other drugs in the streets of the United States, and generating huge amounts of cash through complicated transactions that connect the United States, China, and Latin America. Our understanding from the many sources we've talked to at the federal and international level is that as marijuana became an incredibly attractive sector because of the penalties are low and the money to be made is enormous, is that what Chinese organized crime has done is reinvested a lot of the money it's making off this money laundering into marijuana to make even more money, to generate even more cash. And you really have these interconnected criminal enterprises of drug money laundering of all kinds, marijuana cultivation and trafficking, and smuggling of people. These are networks, sometimes the same networks, sometimes interconnected networks involved in all of this, generating all kinds of money. Most of the laundering, the money moves, a lot of this is controlled by the top level. And these are very complex, murky networks, but at the highest levels, Chinese organized crime, mainly operating out of New York, is running this nationwide. And money is both being laundered in the U.S., but also going back to China.
So many more questions for you, Sebastian, but I want to turn now to joining us on the line now, Darcy McElwain, who is U.S. Attorney for the District of Maine. Darcy, thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you for inviting me to join you today.
Tell us what you can about the investigations in Maine into the illegal activity here.
Yeah, thank you. This is such an important issue, as you've been hearing, and one impacting many communities across Maine. As you've heard from the other call, experts on the call, the grows destroy homes, and all the evidence points to the product being distributed out of state to jurisdictions where marijuana is not legal, and so there's no oversight or regulation of the product and no way to know if it's safe, which is our largest concern. I'm pleased to share that the success of our collective efforts is evident with 40 plus operations shutting down and multiple arrests being made over the last several months across the state. We believe now that there's less than 100 operations that remain active, so you can expect this enforcement action to continue until the individuals operating these illegal grows come to understand that Maine's not a safe or hospitable place for this activity. To date, there's no evidence of illegal immigration associated with the illegal marijuana grows in Maine, and our investigation has encountered no evidence of human trafficking as has been seen in other states. The individuals tending these grows in homes across central Maine have predominantly been revealed so far to be U.S. citizens or lawful permanent residents living in states like New York and Massachusetts who are being paid for their work. As you heard, this is just not a Maine problem alone. We know from DEA that there's currently transnational criminal organizations involved in these activities in at least 20 states, as was recently reiterated by the FBI director last week. And he, of course, stated that in some FBI investigations across the country, they've revealed ties to Chinese organized crime. Investigations in our office are ongoing, and to state at this point who may be benefiting from the proceeds from these grows in Maine or how the proceeds are being used is premature, but the possibility that these criminal enterprises were using Maine properties to profit from the unlicensed marijuana cultivation and interstate distribution made clear that there needs to be a strong and sustained federal, state, and local effort, which is what's happening. So grateful for the highly collaborative work with partners like the Maine Sheriff's and the Maine Attorney General's Office, as well as the commitment from DEA, FBI, HSI, and IRS.
Darcy, you mentioned that you believe there are now fewer than 100 of these houses left. I had read as many as 200. Do you believe that in the recent past there were as many as 200 and that number has diminished?
I think the accurate number that our office has shared publicly is that at a time there was as many as 200, but that not more than that, and that now we strongly believe, confidently believe, that there's less than 100.
What can you tell us about the people living in these homes? You mentioned that when there are people in the homes, that they have been U.S. citizens and that so far no evidence of illegal trafficking. On the other hand, I have seen reports that there are horrific living conditions and that people perhaps are not even being fed. Is that accurate?
It's not. Not based on our investigation, at least. And our investigation is coordinating closely with all our state and local partners. There's no doubt that the conditions in the home are being destroyed in terms of that house being habitable for the future because of the grows and the sustained product that's being grown in them. However, the individuals that we're encountering in these investigations and search warrant executions, I wouldn't use the verb living. They may be tending to the grows. They may be there for periods of time. But anyone who's staying isn't staying for longer than a day or two before leaving and coming back at another time or being exchanged with someone else who's doing the job. And so we haven't seen that people are being treated the way you're describing or that they're not being paid well for their participation in the grows.
And Darcy, before you go, I'm reading from a statement that you made a couple weeks ago. The last sentence was, "No Maine property owner or anyone else should ever be assumed to be part of a criminal enterprise simply because of their surname or nationality." Reading between the lines there, I'm thinking that you are concerned that people who are Asian or Asian American may face discrimination or discomfort because of that in rural Maine. Can you speak to that a little more?
Absolutely. I'm strongly concerned about that, and I appreciate the question. One phenomenon that we've observed in response to the proliferation of these operations and the public attention that the investigation of them has received is that Maine property owners of Chinese or Asian descent are being assumed to be associated with criminal enterprise simply because of their surnames or their nationality. And this is a huge problem, and my office and the Department of Justice condemn such assumptions.
Darcy McElway is the U.S. Attorney for the District of Maine. Thank you for calling in, Darcy. So many more questions. If you have a question for our panel about these marijuana growing operations in Maine, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Find us on social media or send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are learning about the illegal cannabis activity happening in Maine and elsewhere in the country. With me, John Hudak, who is director of Maine's Office of Cannabis Policy, Sebastian Rotella, a journalist with ProPublica, and Aaron Fry, Maine's Attorney General. Share your comments and questions. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. Sebastian, I want to turn back to you. You've talked about these operations in 20-some states, and I'm wondering, is there a pattern? Do these houses proliferate in a state, and then when law enforcement begins to crack down, they move to another state? Or is it just exploding? Are there more and more and more states becoming involved and more operations happening? We heard Darcy McElway say that it seems as though the number in Maine is subsiding, but still less than 100 is still several dozen and a lot for a small state.
I think it's both, in the sense that I think in general you're seeing more and more of these operations around the country and proliferation in all kinds of places, both places you would expect that have long traditions of it, like California, the Pacific Northwest, and states that you wouldn't necessarily expect. But I think you did say something that's very important: the remarkable mobility and resources of these criminal groups. As we traced some of the groups we looked at in Oklahoma that were on major farms that were involved in violent incidents like a quadruple murder, which was a conflict among Chinese underworld figures, we traced them back and saw how these are people who first came to the country, were based in New York, then they were in North Carolina, then they went out to California when there was a real boom in marijuana activity and got very involved there. When law enforcement cracked down, they were part of a wave of people who moved to Oklahoma, joined by people who had been in Colorado. So there is a pattern that as law enforcement cracks down in one place, some of the groups move on to the new hotbed, and they do it with remarkable speed and agility. One of the things we found in Oklahoma was that you had groups that had recently moved from major operations in California that were moving by private plane. So they were flying by bags of money by private plane from their operations in California to Oklahoma and going out and buying farms, which are, you know, much cheaper. Land is very cheap in Oklahoma, and setting up shop and very quickly setting up major operations where money just didn't seem to be an object and quickly making lots of it. So I think there is a remarkable agility, mobility, and organization of this swarm of groups around the country.
Aaron Fry, I want to ask you about if you're seeing any trends. We did mention all these houses are in rural areas, though it seems as though many, many Maine counties. Are there any other things, like are these ranch houses? Are these houses that are vacant and foreclosed upon? I mean, are there any trends that you see and you would like local law enforcement officials to keep in mind?
Yeah, I don't know that I have any other trends. I mean, again, as it's been identified, the, you know, what the investigation is showing, other than rural being consistent, is these operations are trying to stay under the radar. And so, you know, what happens is there's just some, you know, the smell and the power usage are really the only other things that are big indicators that there may be an issue with the way in which the property is being used rurally. And by the way, that's also why we see sheriffs being involved in a lot of these activities, because it's the sheriffs who, in Maine State Police, but they're the ones who are really dogging down in these rural communities how a property might be used. It is indoors, though, too. Something that Sebastian had mentioned is, you know, we had seen a history of grows that may have been, may have been covered farms, but they, you know, they were sort of out in the open. You know, this is trying to find a container around, you know, a property is a container around the illicit activity that's going on. That is the thrust of the trend. I do want to highlight something, though, that the U.S. Attorney for Maine indicated. And that is, there are a lot of partners who are engaged at this on the state and federal level. The U.S. Attorney had identified those. And, you know, what's important is because of the transnational nature of this activity, because you may grow in one place, move the money in another, much like Sebastian was just talking about, it is so critical that we deal with the issue, not just in Maine, but our federal partners are really doing a tremendous job at ensuring that we can follow them, because Maine doesn't operate in Massachusetts. Maine doesn't operate in New York, but the federal government can. And so I suppose to the extent that we're looking at another important thing here, it's the state and federal partnership is so critical in ensuring that these illicit grows are properly addressed.
We're gonna go to a call. We're gonna go to Maggie, who's calling from York Beach. Hi, Maggie, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is that this marijuana is being grown in, you know, rural places in Maine. Are people growing it because they can sell it to drug dealers? And are they courted by them and to sell it? And the other thing is, when you find an illegal drug place, do you actually tell the people that if they apply, they could grow it legally and they could actually make a business out of it instead of being involved in the illegal drug trade? I have friends who grow it here and they're just under so many regulations and they sell it to pharmaceuticals. So maybe these people can still grow if they need to make an income, but do it legally.
Maggie, thanks for your question. I'm going to turn to you, John. What are your thoughts on Maggie's question?
Yeah, the question about whether this product is, being diverted to the illicit market here in Maine is an important one. And I don't have insight into the types of supply chains that are happening. State and federal law enforcement certainly have a better grip on that. But what I will say is that research that our office has commissioned here in Maine demonstrates that more than two-thirds of Mainers who consume cannabis purchase it from legal means or grow it themselves. That's one of the highest rates of legal use in the United States among legal states, which tells me that a lot of Mainers prefer to purchase from the legal medical or adult use market, or as I said, grow it their own, which is very encouraging. Is there an illicit cannabis market in Maine? Absolutely there is. But Maine is doing quite well in capturing large portions of the illicit market. Because if you rewind back to 1999, all cannabis in Maine was being sold illicitly, and so that type of progress is important. And quickly, as a follow up on something the U.S. attorney said about the number of houses that exist here in Maine, transnational drug operations respond very effectively to incentives, and if we can reduce the incentives for their operations in Maine, it is likely going to move them elsewhere. And so individuals who are setting up these houses see some incentive. The attorney general talked a lot about it. Being rural, not every town having its own police department, relying on sheriffs to do that, allows them to hide in plain sight better than if they were in downtown Portland or downtown Bangor, which would be much more difficult. And land being relatively cheap. And so that creates incentives to find a place where you can set up shop. And if law enforcement can decrease those incentives or reverse those incentives, then it drives these types of actors elsewhere.
Maggie, and Jennifer, go ahead.
If I can just add in on something that Director Hudak was just talking about, we are not seeing individuals who actually want to participate in the market but haven't been able to. So that's why they are doing these grows, right? I mean, these grows are intended to be unlawful grows. And so to Maggie's question about, can you redirect individuals into the legal marketplace? Something that is common is that this is not the interest of the folks who are engaging in this activity. So there really wouldn't be any purpose to do that.
Maggie, thanks for your question. Calling in now is Judy Long, who's Senior Manager of Communication and Brand at Versant Power. Thanks for calling in, Judy. We have heard that these grow houses use a massive amount of electricity. Give us a sense of how much more electricity than normal is used by these operations. What are you finding?
Thanks very much for inviting me to join. I'll tell you that at an electric utility, our first concern and our most important work are the safety of our employees and the public. Recently, at some of these residential homes where we're seeing the illegal grows, the electricity use is well outside what would be normal for any household, including someone that was growing marijuana for their personal use. We're talking about usage that's as high as 1,000 kilowatt hours per day, which is more than many or even most homes use in an entire month. So that is definitely beyond what is safe for normal residential electrical infrastructure. So our first concern is the safety of our employees and the public when dealing with these grows.
Well, Judy, correct me if I'm wrong, but if you're going to be using that much electricity, don't you have to rework the system for that? I mean, the grid isn't set up to be feeding a home that much power. How do they get around that? How does that work?
So it's not a case where the grid isn't set up to feed the home, but the home isn't built to receive that amount of electricity. A commercial customer, any sort of business, they have wiring, they have infrastructure that are built for higher energy consumption. But when you talk about taking a residential home that's limited in the amount of electricity that it is built to circulate, risks of fires come along with such usage. And I can tell you that one of the first grows that we were involved with, and in fact, one as recently as last week, we've seen electricity use contribute to extremely dangerous conditions, including a meter box, which is the box on the outside of your home that measures your usage, exceeding 500 degrees Fahrenheit. So in some of these cases, we don't understand how the building didn't catch fire. And obviously, that poses an extreme risk to our workers, to first responders, as well as those living and working in that home.
What is Versant's role in flagging these extreme spikes in energy to law enforcement? Can you look through the records and let the law enforcement agencies know that when you're seeing aberrations?
So customers trust us to keep their personal information private and secure. So right next to safety, that is a pillar of our customer service, taking your information, keeping it private, and protecting it. And we take that trust seriously. But we are looking into and asking questions about how we can effectively work with law enforcement, knowing that the danger exists for some of these homes to burn, for people to suffer bodily injury because of the conditions in some of these homes.
Well, Judy, thank you so much for calling in. Judy Long is with Versant Power. Many of these homes have been in Versant Power's territory. We're going to go to Ethan, who's calling from Saco. Hi, Ethan. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I don't know if you addressed this completely. The question I had was, I did hear you talking a little bit about it, was that the make it legal nationally so that we can tax it. And once you tax it, then you can really crack down on the illegal part of it. And the other thing, it's kind of like prohibition. If you already addressed that, the second part is I drive up Route 26 and Poland and Oxford, but it's everywhere, is that these places are, I mean, I don't know if the product that they're selling is legal or what, was it produced legally? Where was it produced illegally?
Sure, Ethan. I'm hearing two different questions. One I'm going to send to Sebastian and one I'm going to send to John. And John, I'm going to go to you second about asking about the proliferation of dispensaries. And I know what Ethan's talking about. Route 26 seems to have a lot of them as well. But Sebastian, I want to go to you. When you've been doing this research, is part of the conversation that if marijuana were just legal, this wouldn't be happening? Or is that not really something that's a reasonable part of this discussion?
Well, it's certainly part of the debate. It's not one that I've really focused on, because I've really focused on understanding this phenomenon, the role of Chinese organized crime and some of these other aspects. But I will tell you, it was interesting. We did this in-depth series of ProPublica of three articles, and the reaction was overwhelmingly positive. It was very curious, because both people who are strenuously against legalization and people who are strenuously for it like the articles for what I assume are diametrically opposite interpretations, right? But they both, people were saying, see, this is what happens when you don't legalize completely. And others were saying, see, if you were to legalize completely, it would be even worse. I'm agnostic on it. I will say that certainly in these states where legalization has happened, the idea which made sense in theory, which was that, as the caller said, you bring this out into the open, you impose regulation, you impose taxation, you benefit the coffers of the state, and you eliminate organized crime. The opposite has happened, right? You've had an explosion of very aggressive organized crime wherever this has happened. And I will say that in having covered organized crime and drugs all over the world in places like Latin America and Europe and elsewhere, some of the countries, for example, the Netherlands, which has gone close to decriminalization, legalization, has a huge drug and organized crime problem now. So I'm agnostic on it, but I think it's a very complex debate, and it's not clear to me what the answer is.
Ethan, thanks for your question. I'm going to turn to John for the other part of that. How does somebody know when they walk into a dispensary? Ethan mentioned Route 26, that has been grown legally and has been tested. How strictly are you able to monitor that?
So chances are, if you're driving down the street and you're seeing a storefront that sells cannabis, that storefront is legal. Illicit operators tend not to want to have a big sign that points to their illegal business that says, come grow my illegal product here. But if you are curious about it, you can go in. And if it is a legal medical or adult use operator, you can ask to see their license and their licensure from our office. The Office of Cannabis Policy, and if they don't have it, they're supposed to have it. And so we have gotten complaints in the past about illicit storefronts that a lot of times just tend to be a legal operation that someone wasn't familiar with. On the adult use side, you can go on our website and look at a list of all of the legal retail stores in the state, and there have been some confidentiality changes in the law around medical stores that will be able to make that information more public and easier for consumers to find. And then finally, your question about testing. We have mandatory contaminant testing in our adult use program. We do not, unfortunately, have that yet in our medical program. So if you're in an adult use retail store, that product has been tested before it comes to market. If you're in a medical retail store and you're a medical patient, you can ask for a certificate of analysis. And if the operator has that, that would show you the results of voluntary contaminant testing. Not a huge percentage of medical participants do that, but there are certainly a number of them, and that's a good way for medical patients to know what's in their medicine.
All right, and we do have email questions about this, but we do need to go to a break. So when we come back, we're going to talk about more about the quality control. We are talking about illegal cannabis operations in Maine that seem to be proliferating, especially in the last couple of years. Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or find us on social media. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Our topic today, illicit cannabis operations in Maine. Who's behind them and what's being done to stop them? My guest, ProPublica reporter Sebastian Rotella, Attorney General Aaron Fry, and Director John Hudak of the Office of Cannabis Policy. Join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. I'm going to read both of these emails, John. This one's from Sarah. Is there any concern for the cannabis produced by these illegal operations making its way into Maine's legal use storefronts? Additionally, is it required for growers to provide a provenance for the product they supply to these stores? And from Tiffany, with an increasing amount of people legally using cannabis, how can people be sure they aren't getting a product that isn't part of these illegal operations? And more importantly, a safe product that isn't potentially containing unsafe ingredients such as fentanyl. So what you addressed before the break is that the storefronts themselves, you know, probably are not illegal if they are on Route 26 with a sign out front. But what about the product? How can you guarantee, how can your office guarantee that everything sold over the counter there has been obtained through the proper channels?
So there is a process that we call inversion, which is where illicit product makes its way, excuse me, into a regulated supply chain. In our adult use program here in Maine, we have a seed to sale inventory tracking system. So we are able to account for where products are in that supply chain and making sure that illicit products are not making their way into that. Lacking those types of inventory tracking controls in the medical program, we cannot guarantee that inversion is not happening, or diversion, frankly, where medical product is being sent into the illicit market. I think most Maine medical operators are honest players and they're doing the right thing, but the opportunities are there for that type of product to make its way in. What I will say to the question of fentanyl, this is a topic that elected officials at the federal level have made a big deal out of, with essentially no evidence of fentanyl making its way into regulated cannabis. We have had a couple of complaints here and there that have come into the office that allege this. And ultimately, when an investigation is done, it shows that this is typically a polysubstance user, and they used fentanyl while, and they also at some point used cannabis. And so that is not so much of a concern. We haven't seen it happen in either of our programs, and we're comfortable that Maine business owners have no incentives putting a deadly opioid into cannabis medicine or adult use cannabis.
An email here from Matthew. We have a number of these grow houses in our town. They smell terrible. They overburden the power grid. They pay cash for legitimate housing, which now becomes teardowns, and blight the neighborhood. They exploit their workers. That being said, you don't hear a peep from them compared to other loud locals. Aaron, hearing that, what would you say to people like Matthew who know about these houses, or what they believe are these houses in their town? Who do they call, and what kind of information can you use?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you believe that there is a property that is being used for unlawful activity, and by the way, this would apply to any type of unlawful activity, but we're talking about illicit grows today. If you believe that there's a property that's being used inappropriately, report it to your local law enforcement agency. So the municipality or the county that that this emailer is in, call them. Now, he may not get immediate information about what actually might be happening there, or whether or not an investigation does play out until something public is able to be released. But if you suspect that there's an issue, call. Now, one of the tensions is that there is lawful cannabis use, right? And there is the ability to lawfully grow plants for personal use. And there are some other lawful grows. So that is a tension that law enforcement has to work through on a regular basis about what is permitted and what is not. So best you can do is make the report. And I think you could probably trust that law enforcement will indeed take those reports seriously. And if they can, if the evidence supports it, we'll take appropriate action to address the activity.
Sebastian, I want to ask you, you mentioned earlier in the program about a case, I believe you said in Oklahoma, where there was a murder, four people killed. How dangerous are the people who are involved in these grow operations? If somebody like Matthew believes that there are several in his community, is that cause for alarm?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, certainly we have seen a number of cases of violence, and particularly in Oklahoma, which is, as I said, you know, the farms are so big, there's so much money being made, there's so much organized crime involved. I think it's probably one of the places where it's most extreme, but there have been cases like this in California and Colorado as well. Two kind of contradictory things. Chinese organized crime in general tends to be very well organized, disciplined, and restrained. So there's less violence than you would expect given the amount of money and drugs that is being moved on a daily basis than say in Mexican cartels, which I've covered, where the violence is just remarkable and constant. At the same time, you know, routinely there's a lot of cases in Oklahoma that I've looked at, that quadruple murder in which two of the victims themselves have been involved in a shooting and a beating. Often, almost always, there are guns out on these farms, and often in California and Colorado, where I've looked at it, in the houses, which are more comparable to Maine, right, in smaller operations, guns are there. Whenever you have money and drugs, it's a magnet for potential violence, for potential crime. These organizations are disciplined, but there are moments of conflict, right? And the other thing that I think is very important to remember, and one of the callers or people who wrote in cited it, is the exploitation and systematic abuse of the workers. What I've seen in many states, I know the U.S. attorney said that there's less of it in Maine, and that's great, but is mistreatment of workers. Most of the workers in Oklahoma are people who have come recently to the United States, mostly across the Mexican border, so they're illegal immigrants, which makes them even more vulnerable. Often Chinese, I mean, often the victims of Chinese organized crime are themselves Chinese. You have Chinese immigrants in conditions where they're around dangerous pesticides, where there's physical abuse, where they're ripped off in terms of their wages, where they're living in filthy conditions, bad food. Sometimes their movements are restricted or controlled. So people should think about what goes in when organized crime is involved. The treatment of the workers, the exploitation, mistreatment of the workers is a profound and tragic problem that needs to be kept in mind.
We're going to go to Nick, who's calling from Mercer. Hi, Nick. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. And I'm kind of late to the program, so I apologize if this subject's covered. But I grew up in Maine as an Asian American, and I felt really isolated and kind of outcast growing up. And now growing up, as an adult, I don't really have that issue. I am the parent of a mixed race kid. So I'm starting to feel a little uncomfortable as somebody who's visibly Asian. I've worked hard all my life living in rural areas around predominantly white people to fit in. And yeah, honestly, I'm starting to feel a little targeted. A lot of the anger and aggression towards the Asian growers and just the words coming out of people's mouths is, it feels a little uncomfortable, to be honest.
Nick, thank you so much for calling in. And I'm so sorry to hear that. Attorney General Aaron Fry, are you worried about a risk of hate crimes against Asian Americans in Maine? Are you hearing reports that reflect what Nick is telling you about his own experience?
Those reports haven't gotten up to me, but I am concerned, and you heard this from the U.S. attorney as well. The one thing that we are not looking at when we are investigating is nationality, race, ethnicity. That is an inappropriate focus. It's not our concern. And frankly, Maine people would do well to focus on the activity that is concerned here, which is using property for unlawful activity. It doesn't matter who you are, right? And so not only are we focused on the unlawful activity, regardless of who's doing it, this is a good opportunity, and I appreciate Nick calling in to express this concern, because I do not want to see some sort of backlash because folks are inappropriately connecting an ethnicity with an activity, because we're going after the activity. I understand there's reports of how different folks may be using this across the country. In Maine, we're just focused on the grows, and it's not because of ethnicity. It's because the properties are being used unlawfully by a range of different people.
John Hudak.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of important points here, and I agree with everything that the Attorney General just said, but illicit grows, no matter who is participating in them, whether you're white, black, brown, Asian, anything else, is a threat to the legal regulated market. And as the Attorney General said earlier, a threat to public health as well. And I think the caller's point here, which was a really difficult one to hear, shows that this type of illicit drug activity has far-reaching victims. We think about the victims of participation in illicit activities, but there are indirect and secondary victims to these types of situations. And when you have a group of individuals who perhaps come from a certain place or look a certain way, people react to that, unfortunately. We've seen that throughout this country's history. And there are other people who are not breaking the law, who fall into those same demographic groups, who do experience that type of blowback. And, I have every faith that state and local and federal law enforcement are just going after people because they're growing illicitly. But more victims are in the wake of that.
And Aaron, you want to follow up?
Yeah, I just want to add one point that I neglected, and that is my office has seen where the public has inappropriately targeted an ethnicity because of concerns over, thinking back during COVID, right? We saw across the nation hate inappropriately directed at an ethnicity because of misunderstandings. So my office will address activity that's based on hate. And I just want to stress that because we have seen it before. I am concerned, as Nick described, that if we're not careful in how we talk about what this is, we risk stereotyping something that will lead to hateful behavior towards specific populations.
And Sebastian, I want to ask you what you've seen in other states.
Well, we did one of the stories we did in Oklahoma was very much about this, about the reaction of the Chinese American community in Oklahoma and their concern that in the very legitimate crackdown and a very tough crime problem that there was excess or bias. And that's obviously one of the tragedies of this. As John said, you have lots of victims in these cases. And having covered now for several years, both the aggressive activities of both Chinese organized crime and the malign activity of the Chinese state overseas, what I often find is Chinese Americans find themselves in a kind of crossfire where they are targeted by Chinese organized crime. Sometimes if you have people involved in dissident activity or pro-democratic activity targeted by the Chinese state, but also viewed with suspicion or bias by U.S. law enforcement or fellow citizens. So that's a tragic and very difficult problem. On the other hand, I think as the Chinese American federal agents I talk to on a regular basis say, or the human rights, Chinese American human rights advocates, we also have to understand where problems are coming from. The fact is, all of the reporting and indicates that the dominant player in money laundering for drug cartels and one of the major players in marijuana, illegal marijuana in the United States, is Chinese organized crime. And that needs to be a focus. And there's a language barrier, a cultural barrier. We need more people in law enforcement who speak the language, who understand those cultures. But that's a reality, just as most of the fentanyl and cocaine comes from Mexico, or in the past, Italian-American organized crime was involved in certain activities. You have to understand who's doing it in order to fight it well and understand those cultures with all the restraint and sensitivity and precaution not to fall into stereotype or bias that is fundamental to the way America works.
What is the, we just have a few seconds left, but Sebastian, what is the question that you're pursuing now and the work that you've done? What do you really want to try to figure out?
Well, the ongoing question, which we looked at in these stories and in future ones, is how the complex interconnections with Chinese organized crime and the Chinese state work. And that's a whole conversation to have. And some of it is clear and some of it is murky, but that's one ongoing thing. What we are looking at right now is something I mentioned just a moment ago, which is the abuse and the exploitation and the mistreatment of workers, which is, you know, going on around the United States and overseas as well.
Well, we'll follow your reporting at ProPublica, and thank you so much for doing that. And thank you all for joining us on the show today. Aaron Fry, the Attorney General for the State of Maine, John Hudak, Director of Maine's Office of Cannabis Policy, and Sebastian Rotella, who you just heard, a reporter for ProPublica. Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to do a program we tried to do a few weeks ago. So tomorrow, the many benefits of walking and good places to take a walk in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.